Let's get going. Hour number three. It's Friday. We're going to take a look back at the week in terms of the coronavirus and the impact on the entire world. We have to remember, it's not just here. We're not getting news reports of the rest of the world to speak of, and it's happening everywhere. It's just, it's crazy. When you look at some of the lockdowns now in the UK, some of Boris Johnson's pronouncements, and other countries, what's going on in Germany, it's pretty brutal on people. I don't know how else to phrase it. What's going on in South Australia, same thing. You cannot go outside of your house to walk the dog or get any exercise now. You have to stay in. It's just beyond 1984. Donald Trump Jr. tested positive, apparently, today. And now I get word that Rudy Giuliani's son has tested positive today. And I was just trying to think back of it. There's a long list of Republicans who've tested positive. It's interesting. John Kerry says the Great Reset is needed to stop the rise of populism. Another interesting comment. There's a lot of interesting comment out there, and we'll just give you a few of them here. What we're going to do now is welcome Dr. Henry Nyman back to bring us up on the scientific side of this issue as it is formally assessed and analyzed by a world that has never had to deal with anything like this before, and we just don't know what's ahead. It's a mystery. They're talking about a dark winter. It's looking like that may exactly be what's coming. Hello, Henry. Welcome back.
Hello, Jeff. Good to be back. And yes, the description of a dark winter is pretty accurate. And it's not really that big of a surprise, but the levels are moving into the alarming stage, and that's why you're seeing these additional measures being taken in Europe, and actually they're starting up in the U.S. again. Mm-hmm. And it's really and there have been a couple things this week that kind of stood out and raises concerns that just watching to see what's going to happen is not going to be the way to go. The virus frequency of increases is growing pretty dramatically, and the number of cases and the number of deaths are both growing pretty dramatically. Today was a new all-time high for the number of cases that were confirmed, and this is just in the 50 states, plus the District of Columbia is based on the reports that the states put out. Most of them put it out daily. And it's up to today's total. It might get a little higher with California, but it's 192,910. So it's getting real, real close to 200,000 cases. And if you recall, there was talk of it going to 100,000. cases.
Yeah, I remember.
Not that long ago. And that seemed like a big number because, right, you know, it was only in the neighborhood of 20,000 cases back when the big outbreaks happened in the spring. And then the numbers didn't go down that low. And then in the summer, the numbers got up to 50, 60,000 cases a day, and then dropped down to 40,000. And if you recall, Fauci was saying that, you know, he would much prefer to get down to 10,000 cases a day before we go into the fall. And most of the scientists anticipated that the fall wave would be significantly larger than the spring or the summer. Most of the world didn't even have a summer outbreak. It really just had the spring outbreak, and it dipped down. But they were worried about the fall. And the reason is not, you know, something that was, you know, highly speculative. And it was just the way pandemics work. You know, the your listeners could, you know, just think back. Most of them can recall the swine flu outbreak, although I guess some groups denied that was happening when it was happening. I remember that I was
that I don't
going
remember.
Around.
I believe you, but I don't remember that one. That's crazy.
Oh, I definitely remember.
I was actually all over the place. Yeah.
Yeah, but people didn't believe it was real. I mean, just to give me one example, because, you know, I was following it and mapping it and basically set up, you know, a website that was putting up the news and people could join and make comments.
Well, you were on the program here, Henry, reporting on that back then.
Right. But I'm giving you an example. I got to see a lot of the rumors, and actually, I was on Alex Jones then, and he didn't think swine flu was real. You know, I went on and said, "Oh yeah, it's a real thing. You know, sequences are out. It's really, you know, in swine and da 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 da." And he was shocked at that. This was the first he had heard of a scientist actually saying that this wasn't real. This was real. Sorry. And he was taken aback by me demanding, you know, insisting that this was a real thing. And to give you an example, because this is one of the rumors, you know, this parallel universe stuff that gets out there. And this one I was very familiar with, and I knew exactly how the rumor started. Mm-hmm. And what the rumor was based on and why the rumor was just absolutely false. But a lot of people believed it. And it really came down to, and it's worth going over this because the swine flu really provides a roadmap of what has happened with COVID and what's going to happen with COVID. And back then, if you recall, the swine flu started in the spring, late spring, it started to take off. Well, it wasn't even taken off. It was identified. And it was identified in two boys that were in adjacent counties in Southern California. One was in San Diego County, the other was in Imperial County. And neither of them had any exposure to swine and didn't have any exposure to each other. And the fact that they both had the same virus, it was a triple reassortant, and, you know, there was no doubt that this was, that there were other swine flu viruses circulating, but this one was kind of unique. Some of the segments had a Asian origin, some of the segments had a North American origin, and they were triple reassortant. So some of the segments were avian and some were swine and some were human. And so there was no doubt that the two boys were infected by the same virus. And the fact that they didn't have contact with swine or each other, but they both had the same virus, indicated that there were a whole lot of people that hadn't been, you know, that had been infected and had led to the infections in these independent infections in these two young boys. And it was right. Pretty clear that the virus was transmitting in humans. And what happened is shortly after that, it became more common. But it never really got that common that it was a lot of the people that were positive were students that had gone on spring break down to Mexico, and they got infected and they came back to their schools and started spreading in those individual schools. And it kept on going after flu season kind of ended. I mean, flu season kind of starts to fade and in March, and it gets pretty light in April, and by May, it's usually pretty much gone. But in this case, it didn't. It really kind of hung in there, and the seasonal flu disappeared. So, mm-hmm. So the only flu that was circulating was swine flu by May or so. You know, that was it. And then over the summer, it persisted. It would show up in summer camps, and, you know, they would deny that it was swine flu, and they would say it was a mystery illness.
Yeah, mystery illness.
Da-da-da-da-da. But here comes the rumor, okay? So in the fall, it started to pick up speed. And the CDC was actually doing the testing there in Atlanta. So it was a big pain because you basically had to take samples and ship them to Atlanta and wait for the CDC to test them to confirm that it was swine flu. And they were backlogged, and it makes it very difficult. I mean, usually the clinician wants to know right away. And so universities started setting up their own testing, and they did that here in Pittsburgh at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. They developed an in-house assay. And it turned out that if you didn't have the in-house assay, you could still tell what was going on because seasonal flu never came back. So in the fall, there was no seasonal flu anymore. It had been out-competed by swine flu. The only flu that was circulating at the time was swine flu. And even though the test for swine flu was still limited to the CDC or some universities that were setting it up, Most of the labs could do an influenza A test, okay? Because swine flu is influenza A, and it would be positive on the influenza A test. And so a lot of local labs just did influenza A to see if you had swine flu. And if you were influenza A positive, that meant that you had swine flu because there was no other influenza A circulating at the time. And what happened was a technician who had you know, worked in the lab previously had used the influenza A test previously, and previously influenza A meant that you had seasonal flu. This is before there was a swine flu. And the only influenza A that was circulating, you know, on rare occasions if there was H5N1, but, you know, that was in Asia. In the United States, if you had influenza A, you either had seasonal H1N1 or you had seasonal H3N2. And in the fall, they were instructed, run the influenza A test, and if it's positive, to label the sample as swine flu positive. And the technician thought that this was some type of conspiracy because she knew that influenza A meant that you had seasonal flu. And they were running the exact same test they had run in the past. And instead of calling it seasonal flu, they were told to call it swine flu. And she thought that that was a plot. That was a mystery plot to basically take seasonal flu positive patients and label them as swine flu. And so all these swine flus that were being reported by the media and by the scientists were based on the tests being positive for influenza A. And her experience was influenza A meant seasonal flu, And therefore, they were mislabeling the results and calling it swine flu. And everything she tested was positive, were influenza A positive. He said, well, that always used to mean that they had seasonal flu. And so this was a plot to take seasonal flu cases and call it swine flu. And that has a bit of a ring to it. If you listen to the wacko, stuff that's floating around today, they say, oh, everybody that's in the hospital that is test positive for COVID, they're not dying from COVID. They're dying from their underlying condition. And so it's another plot. They're not dying from COVID, even though they're infected with COVID. They're dying from, they said that about Herman Cain. They went and said, well, Herman Cain didn't die from COVID. He was COVID positive, and he happened to go to Trump's rally in Tulsa, and he didn't wear a mask, and he developed symptoms, a week after the rally, and he went in the hospital, and he went in the ICU, and he died. But the reason he died is because he had cancer. Well, he did have cancer.
Yeah.
He did have stage 4 cancer.
Correct. Yeah. He had bad cancer.
But that's not why he died. He died because he had COVID.
How do you look at it, Henry? Do you look at it like COVID will push somebody with severe comorbids over the edge and knock them off?
What does it do?
How does it work?
He had pneumonia and he died from viral pneumonia. He didn't die from cancer.
He was on a ventilator. He couldn't breathe.
I'll tell you very clearly. He died because he couldn't breathe. Cancer doesn't cause you to not be able to breathe.
I know that.
Viral pneumonia does.
Is there any connection between COVID and severe comorbidities that you have come across scientifically? Any connection at all?
Yeah.
Or are they just two different people on a lifeboat?
You're more likely to die if you have comorbidities because you can't handle the virus. And you can't handle the viral pneumonia, and you die from viral pneumonia. You don't die because you had cancer. Your lungs are full of fluid. They don't fill with fluid because you've got cancer.
I got that.
They fill with fluid because you have a virus.
I got to expand on my question, please. I understand your question. No. Let me try again here. Because of the polybasic.
It's really not that hard. Okay, go ahead and try again. Try again.
All right.
Go ahead.
Because of the polybasic nature of the virus, it can affect every major body organ system.
Right.
Depending upon your comorbidity, might that give it a better edge to push you over the immunological total fail for whatever reason than you otherwise would get? Is the virus a deciding factor in any cases of comorbidities?
The virus is the deciding factor because it causes viral pneumonia. And the viral pneumonia causes your lungs to fill up with fluid.
When your
lungs are full of fluid, you can't breathe and you die because you can't breathe.
Henry, you're talking down a little bit. Just don't do that. Please, it doesn't become you. You're a scientist.
That is how simple it is. You die because you got the virus.
That doesn't invalidate my question at all. Seeking to get clarity and not dismissal.
Yeah, the clarity is that the poly basic cleavage site doesn't keep it from causing pneumonia in the lungs.
I wouldn't say it would. I'm not dumb.
And that's why he died. And that's why he died.
I get that.
So what's confusing about that?
I simply asked if the poly basic cleavage
the reason he died 10 days after he went to Tulsa, or the reason he developed symptoms that soon, and the reason he ended up in the ICU, and the reason he died 3 weeks after he went to Tulsa, was because he was infected with the virus. And he couldn't handle the virus as well as
because of his
teenager,
stage 4 cancer.
Because of his stage 4 cancer. But that's not what killed him.
I never said it did. I simply asked if it had any factor at all to play in his comorbidity. The answer is apparently no.
No, that's not what I said. If you have comorbidities, you can't handle the virus as well.
You're battling multiple things. Precisely what I asked in the middle. My words were, did it push people who are seriously ill already over the edge? And you just said yes. So thank you. You answered the question. Got it.
He died from COVID. Okay? That's what killed him. He didn't die from the cancer. The cancer basically knocks out his immune system.
And?
Okay.
That opened the door for the virus to kill him.
No, that opens him up for more all kinds of infections. So you can have infections, including bacterial infections, throughout your body. So you end up by dying because you're septicemia. You've got bacteria growing. You die from bacteria because your immune system is knocked out. You can't handle something as simple as a bacterium. And that's how people with cancer end up dying, because their immune system isn't working.
No, gone. Now, let me jump over to
Kane
the heart
attack.
Kane
died because he had viral pneumonia. It didn't have anything to do with a polybasic cleavage site. It had to do with the fact that the virus took over his lungs. And the reason
and attacked his kidneys or liver or something else, then it would have been a different story. He could have died from something else. Kidney failure. But the virus, in this case, went for his lungs. I got it.
And that's why he was in the ICU, and that's why he was on the ventilator.
Okay, now let me go back to the other story that has been of great concern, actually for, I think, both of us. I think I can speak for you on this. And that's the younger people throwing clots now, the thickening of the blood, and heart attacks, and observable heart damage by MRI scans of people who have purportedly recovered. What's the latest on that? That's a whole morass of different problems caused by this virus. Thickening of the blood, clots, heart damage.
And it's still doing it. I mean, that's still a problem. And it's still not clear what the long-term effects of that are. And it's not like anything's really that new, other than the fact that that's an additional complication that can cause serious problems. And that's another reason for flattening the curve. Because when the hospitals get overwhelmed, like they're getting overwhelmed now, and they don't have enough healthcare workers to take care of the patients, because there's too many coming in simultaneously, then they can run into some of these problems with clots, that if they have the resources, they can manage those clots. And if they don't, they don't manage them, people end up dying from the clot. And so that is one of the additional factors that is associated with the virus. And that is one of the reasons it causes so many problems. And that's another reason why there's these stupid rumors that when a 20-year-old student that gets diagnosed with COVID and then is found dead in her dorm a couple days later, and she died from a blood clot, they don't they don't say that she died from COVID. They say she died from a blood clot. I mean, the whole thing is stupid. It's very clear that this virus can kill you many different ways. And there's clinicians out there that want to ignore the obvious and think it's a coincidence that the fact that she died 3 days after she was diagnosed with COVID and it was from a blood clot had something, was a coincidence. It wasn't.
I would like to think
that
she
had COVID.
If they did an autopsy, they'd check. Now, the word's out on this, that they check her for certainly COVID, and they check her for thickened blood. That's what I would think.
Yeah.
I think that would be appropriate.
The report was that they did not, the diagnosis was not COVID. The diagnosis was a blood clot.
So I wish they had a test.
You can talk to whatever doctor. Yeah. So, anyway.
Here, another one. The governor of Florida is now positive. Governor Rick Scott.
Yeah, I know. And Don Jr. actually was positive earlier, either beginning of the week or so. The Giuliani's son was diagnosed today or yesterday.
That's today.
Today,
I think. They held, yeah, the Don Jr. thing is
Well, they released it today, you know, exactly when he took the test. I don't know if he took the test today or yesterday, but they announced it today. And they actually talked about Don Jr. today, but he had been tested at the beginning of the week. And Rick Scott said that he didn't get infected when he was in Washington. He got infected when he got back to Florida. But the numbers are going to go up, and they are heavily weighted on the Republican side. And part of the reason they're overweighted on the Republican side is that they don't wear masks. And I mean, Giuliani's son was at his press conference where he was sweating and all his hair dye was running down the sides of his face, his father. And they weren't wearing masks. And Rick Scott usually doesn't wear masks. And Don Jr. usually doesn't wear masks. And that's why you see a lot more Republicans than Democrats with COVID. And my guess is the numbers are going to go up. Because why I'm saying there's going to be this dark winter. And to give you an idea on why it's going to be dark, the CDC is getting a little bit more scientific and a little bit more vocal now. So, you know, Trump's influence is beginning to wane. You know, they kind of realize that he's got his foot out the door. And in any event, they did have a teleconference this week by the CDC. They haven't had one in months. And this teleconference was actually on Thanksgiving. And, you know, why they're recommending that you limit Thanksgiving and that you not celebrate with people outside of your immediate family who you normally see. And then they issued a bunch of precautions to take in case you want to go ahead and do it, but they still recommend that you have 10 or less as far as the size of the party. But they came out a couple days ago with the teleconference, which is what they used to do, you know, almost weekly at the beginning of the outbreak. And actually, they were doing it more than that. They were doing them almost daily at one point. And the task force came out and did a presentation also. And Trump wasn't there, and Pence didn't really say much. And it was pretty much done by the scientists. And they were kind of raising the alarms by how quickly the cases were going up and how widespread they were. And some locations like North and South Dakota actually had infection rates, per capita rates, that were the highest in the world. And that's why, even though the rest of the world has cases, everybody's got their eyes on the U.S. because the U.S. has more cases than anybody else. And what came out of the analysis was, why do you think they had an explosion of cases in the upper Midwest?
Well, in what time frame? Recently?
Recently, it really started probably a couple of weeks ago, and right now they're number one in the world. And so why? And it's not just North and South Dakota. It's, you know, in Montana, and it's in it's mostly in the upper Midwest. And you want to take a guess as to why they think
my guess is, my guess is, and you'll have the specifics, that this virus is going to run from stem to stern, top to bottom of this country. There was a story I ran yesterday that the military even couldn't stop it if they were to enforce lockdowns. That was put out. I think the virus is that infectious. I think it hasn't really gone through, plowed through the Midwest yet, like it is now. School in session may have something to do with it. You tell me.
Snowstorm.
Oh, the big cold snap.
They're blaming it on the cold snap with the snow, and everybody ended up being indoors. And so combination of the snow and forcing everybody indoors led to the rapid spread of the virus, and that's why they've got such a high rate now, is it really started a couple of weeks ago with that cold snap. And if that's accurate, then you know, the forecast for much of the U.S., I know I paid more attention for Pittsburgh, but it was a good part of the U.S., is it's going to be a mild winter. There's an El Nino, and temperatures are going to be above normal here in Pittsburgh. They were going to be above normal in
that far north.
December
and January. I read it was supposed to be a cold winter. Interesting. Well, that'd be nice.
Maybe in the northwest or something. But this was mostly in the Midwest and going more towards the East Coast. And then it was going to be very much above normal in February. So that was kind of good news. But the bad news is that it's still going to be winter. And it does get colder in the winter, and people do end up staying inside, and they stay inside even more if it's sure. Snowy. And if this cold snap that kind of came through went and caused that big of a increase in cases in the upper Midwest, then things are really going to go downhill just because people are spending more time inside, and the virus hangs around more when it's colder and humidity's down. So those are
What you're calling the CDC's recommendations and Fauci's for Thanksgiving? What do you think people should do?
Well, I think they should pay attention because, I mean, here's what the deal is. The deal is that, and some of this was, you know, a week ago, but just to update, the two vaccines, the two mRNA vaccines, messenger RNAs, that basically...
Right. Minus 94 vaccines.
Well, it's not as bad for Moderna. Moderna says it just has to be like at minus 20, and that's because they both use the liposomes. They both use these kind of lipid balls of fat that they encapsulate the RNA in, and because of how what the composition is of the liposome, the Moderna doesn't have to have as severe a cold chain as the Pfizer product. But both of them are giving like 95% protection. It's kind of the analysis is, as I mentioned last week, that they've for Pfizer, I think they've vaccinated something like 41,000 people. And then they did their first analysis when they had results on the first 94 that had been positive for the virus. Mm-hmm. And then they looked to see those 94 that were infected, whether they had been given the placebo or had been given the vaccine, and 95% of those that were infected had been given the placebo. So that's how they came up with that number. And then Pfizer was initially 90%, but then they had another 100 that developed were positive. And so when they look at the 194, the success rate went higher, went up to 95%, similar to Moderna's. And then they had a little bit more variety there, and they had more elderly in the placebo group that had developed the disease, the infection. And so there's a comparison. You know, they kind of look and say, well, you know, if they have these elderly patients that got infected, then, you know, a similar number of elderly patients that got the vaccine and they didn't get infected. And so they extrapolate that and say that it works in elderly patients. And I think it was a 94% success rate in the elderly. And then they did the same thing for severe disease, that several of the patients develop severe disease, and they were either all or almost all in the placebo group. And so that same type of extrapolation was that the vaccine prevents severe disease. And as they go along, more and more people are going to get infected, especially those with the placebo. And then they'll have a better idea on who benefits from the vaccine. Now, a couple of groups weren't included in the original test, and there's some concerns about that. Pregnant women weren't included, and children under the age of 12 weren't included. So it's not really clear how well the vaccine works on either of them group, those two groups, because they weren't tested. And as they go along and get more data, then they can stratify the population more and see different age groups. So initially, the beneficiaries of the rollout are going to be healthcare workers, first responders, and then those over 65 with underlying conditions. And then as they go along, they'll expand it. So Pfizer did file for an emergency use authorization today. Right. And it takes about 3 weeks or so to go through, because, you know, like I say, they've got 41,000 people that were vaccinated, so they got to go through, you know, who did get the vaccine, and then, you know, who did get, you know, did turn positive, and then how that broke down. So it takes them about 3 weeks to go through and grant it. And assuming they're going to grant that, then, you know, it's projected that this year, probably middle to end of December, they'll be able to start rolling out the product. Because that's the one thing that was done with the Warp Speed is the government pretty much said, well, we're going to buy X units of the vaccine regardless of whether it's approved or not. That essentially they selected six companies to do this with, and there were two that were using the mRNA platform, two that were using adenovirus platforms, and two that were using recombinant DNA technology platforms. And so as a result, these companies went ahead and made you know, the vaccine that was ordered, and so there's vaccine that was already made before approval. I mean, it actually doesn't even have the approval yet. But assuming it does get approved in the next 3 weeks, then there will be vaccine ready. Whereas normally what happens is, you know, the companies wait until they get approval because they don't want to make a lot of vaccine if it's not approved. And so then there's a delay. They got to get the approval, then they got to scale up the vaccine. So they're a little bit ahead of that.
Right. Got another story today. Go ahead.
Okay. I was going to say.
Yeah, go on.
Okay, why don't you go?
The other story today was that if there is some concern now, and I forget which company it was. They were in the vaccine biz. And they said if the virus mutates, not a lot, there is some concern that the vaccine will become ineffective. How does that traditionally work in your experience? How much does a vaccine have to hang on to a stable virus or vice versa? How much does a stable virus have to change for it to evade the vaccine effects? This was a problem presented by a professional, right. not gossip, and I can't remember which story it was.
Right. No. Well, that's how evolution works. I mean, basically, the viruses generally don't need a lot of change. They just need the right change in the right place. Mm-hmm. And it's not that the virus is that smart that it picks the right, you know, change in the right place. It's that virus makes a lot of changes. And when they hit on one that's the right change in the right place, then evolution takes over. And then that gives that mutation an advantage. And therefore, it can basically infect people that have already been vaccinated. Or if it's not a vaccine, they can infect people that have already been infected previously and made vaccines against a natural infection. So it doesn't take a lot of change. Now, the good news about the 95% success rate indicates that the Italian strain, which has a single change that in the spike protein that appears to allow the virus to multiply, replicate quicker, and might be able to attach to receptors with a little better affinity, and can spread more easily. And because of its ability to spread more easily, the Italian strain has pretty much taken over. So virtually everything in the U.S. now is the Italian strain. And the fact that people were recently immunized, and they would have been immunized with the original strain because that's what they used. They had their platform, and they had to make, in the case of the messenger RNA, they had to make the messenger RNA target, and they used the sequence from the original virus, which did not have the Italian strain mutation. But the fact that it's 95% would indicate that the Italian lineage, that mutation in the spike protein, doesn't appear to be enough to overcome the effects of the vaccine, because that's not who's getting infected. The people that are getting infected are the ones that were given the placebo, not the vaccine. So the vaccine currently works against the Italian strain. I mean, that was one of the early concerns. Right. Is that everybody was using the original strain, and is the Italian strain different enough? But there's some data from the mink study that you know, there's this big outbreak in mink farms in Europe. I think it's mostly in the Netherlands. And they're looking at viruses circulating there. And there are a couple changes in those, in the spike protein also, that do seem to allow the virus to evade people that have modest levels of immunity. Those that seem to have very strong immunity still are able to handle these mutations, but people that just developed moderate immunity and don't seem to work very well against these mutations. So there's a lot of variables to go into. You know, what does it take to escape? And, you know, the escape is somewhat dependent upon what you're escaping from. So some people are going to have a higher level of immunity than other people. And so the escape may not work for those that have very strong immunity, but that may work for those that have just a modest level of immunity. So that's a warning sign with the mink farms, is that there are some variants out there that if people have a modest level of immunity, they're still susceptible. And the other piece of data is that there are, you know, increasing numbers of people that report being infected the second time. And this probably happens more often than is reported, because there's a lot of skepticism about a second infection, and they figure, oh, maybe this is just the first infection and the virus kind of got knocked down and then kind of reemerged, and it's really the same virus. And it's just kind of at a higher level, and they get infected again. Or they think that it's just dead virus, and they're giving a positive PCR, but they're not really infectious. But in cases where they actually do sequence, they sequence the original, you know, the virus from the first infection, and then they compare it to the virus in the second infection, and there are significant differences, well, then the conclusion is that these were two independent infections. And the person was susceptible to a second infection. And it is an indication that didn't necessarily have to mutate away. It could just be that there's more virus. And that's what the concern is. And that's one of the comparisons to the swine flu. If you recall, I've kind of recounted this before, but it's worth bringing up again since you're asked about mutations. That when the flu came to Pittsburgh, initially people had mild versions of the infection. So they had coughs. They weren't sick enough to miss school, and they weren't sick enough to go to the doctor. And they really weren't being diagnosed. They were just saying, I don't know, something's going around school. And then a couple months later, they all got sick at a much higher level. They had fever. They got tested. They were positive, and they put out warnings, and the absentee rate went up. And it's not clear that there was really a major difference in the mutations of the virus. It is possible that there was just selection for people that had a higher level of virus, or for people that could be infected by two or three people in the same environment and get a higher viral load, and that's what gave the more severe disease. So sometimes a severe disease can just be viral load related and doesn't really take a mutation.
All right.
But anyway, the numbers are going up. I didn't get a chance to go over it, but yeah, it was an all-time high today, almost 200,000. And the deaths are up to about 22,000 a day now, which the latest projection is that by March 1st, in the U.S., there'll be 470,000 dead. And I think that's a low number. So that gives you an idea. And,
all right. Well,
we'll see how it plays out.
Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Take care. And we'll keep watching.
Okay. You too. Take care.
Bye. Thanks. All right. Okay. That's our program on this Friday night. Here we go into a weekend, and watch how fast it goes. Talk soon. Take care. You know where you can find the news. We'll be at the helm 24/7. Take care.